Welcome back to the Tapes Archive Podcast, where we release interviews that have never been heard before. Please listen to episode 000, an introduction, for the full backstory about this podcast series. On this episode, we have songwriter, musician, and Wilco's frontman, Jeff Tweedy. At the time of this interview in 1997, Tweedy was 30 years old and out on tour with Wilco in support of the band's highly acclaimed second record, Being There. In the interview, Jeff talks about bonding with his son while being a house dad, an encounter with a drunken self-entitled fan in Norway, getting the Beach Boys sound in the studio, and why one of the Kinks albums is an all-time favorite of his. On a side note, we also hear why after this podcast is posted, Peking, Illinois will be hitting the unsubscribe button to the Tapes Archive podcast. As always, we have music critic Mark Allen at the helm conducting the interview. Before we get to the interview, we have a couple of housekeeping items. If you would like to support the show, please go over to the website at thetapesarchive.com and click on the support button. On there, you'll find many ways to show your support for the show, and all of them are free. While on the website, check out Mark's blog for more context of this interview and for some personal insight from Mark himself. One last thing, the Tapes Archive podcast is a proud member of the Osiris Podcast Network, a global community connecting passionate fans with podcasts and experiences about artists and topics you love. Thanks for tuning in, and now it's time to open the vault.
Jeff?
Yes?
Hi, it's Mark Allen in Indianapolis. How you doing?
Pretty good, how are you?
Good. Just having a busy day, huh?
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. It's not a problem. I'm sitting here doing other things, so it's tough to be in demand, huh?
No, it's just I don't get over here very often to the office, so... When I get over here, there's lots of stuff to do.
Yeah, I guess like every other critic in the world, I'll tell you, I really enjoy this record. I think it's terrific.
And, oh, thanks.
And I was thinking that the title is too short, and maybe that if you had a longer title, you would have called it Being There Would Be Infinitely Preferable to Being Here.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's sort of the message of the record, isn't it?
I don't know if there's a specific point or message. I think we might have had one in mind when we were still thinking about making it a single CD, but it felt better to have it kind of clouded up by the whole double thing, so I don't know.
I want to ask about some of the songs, and Kingpin really struck me a lot, and especially the rhyme of Dime a Tap and Spinal Tap. And I figure that's another thing that's sort of prevalent. You're kind of balancing the child thing and the rock star thing, aren't you?
Kind of, yeah. It was a little easier making the record because we made it in Chicago, but now that we're touring a lot, it's a little harder, you know. So I feel bad that I'm gone as much as I am now.
Mm-hmm. How old is your little boy?
He's just a little over a year now.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so just starting to walk and all that?
Starting to walk, talk, and getting his teeth, and he's hilarious.
Yeah, that's a good age. Yeah. Are a lot of these songs, I mean, were you thinking about your son and the prospects of leaving him when you were writing?
I was thinking about the prospect of being a dad, actually, when I wrote a lot of the materials before he was born, you know. And then a little bit, you know, a lot of the record was recorded right after he was born. So, yeah, it was definitely on my mind, you know. I've spent a lot of years thinking about one thing, particularly kind of monomaniacally directing all my energy towards music, and just wondering if that was going to be a really horrible thing if I'd be able to switch gears enough to be a good dad, you know.
Mm-hmm. And have you?
I think so. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of ironic. You know, I felt good about it and kind of came to terms with it in a lot of ways making the record, and now I'm I'm back in the middle of it again because I have no choice. I'm like, you know, out on the road, and it's really hard to just think about anything else, you know.
Yeah.
I miss him terribly, but it's like you're so immersed in it, you know, I tend to stress out of it, about it the same way I used to, you know, I like playing music a lot, but where I stress out about it is just wanting to get better and, you know, things like that, which really aren't important.
Yeah, are you so far the kind of dad you thought you'd be?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're really, I mean, when I'm home 24 hours a day generally, and we like, I think we've bonded quite a bit compared to a lot of like dads in the first year. You know, been a kind of a house dad, and doing all the feeding and changing diapers and things like that that I know my dad never did, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, dads are different these days.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Also in Kingpin, are you saying living in Pekin?
Pekin, Illinois, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I thought, God, that's a strange thing to say. have you been to Pekin?
No, I've never been to Pekin, but I just kind of pictured it, you know, just... I don't know. I think the idea was be great to be like a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah, that's not the small pond you want to be in, though.
No, probably not.
I think that's a real polluted gene pool there myself. But
yeah.
I lived and worked in Springfield for a couple of years, and have a good friend who lives in Peoria, and so I've been through Pekin a few times.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well, anyway, maybe I should have gone there.
That's okay. It's like...
I've never been to New Madrid either, so...
Yeah. On Out of Mind, how hard was you know, that, which has an obvious Beach Boy sound, how hard was it to create that sound? Was it as complex as everybody says that it was for the Beach Boys?
Well, I don't think it sounds as good as the Beach Boys, for one thing. No, it wasn't. It was a lot of fun. You know, luckily we had access to that real echo chambers, and we had access to you know, several pianos. So there's like, and I think it's a lot easier to do that now because the 24-track recording isn't really what they had to work with. And Phil Spector recorded the Wall of Sound stuff, which, you know, is obviously the main influence on those Beach Boys recordings. It was all the musicians, like 20 of them in a single room, and recording on 4-track or 8-track. And that's why it sounds better, you know. That's why it is a wall of sound. We kind of made a partition of sound.
How did you do it? I mean, was it routine, or is it something different or special that you did?
I mean, we're just honestly, most of the recording, we're just having a good time, and we do a song a day, and that song took us a day to do. We set up in the morning with tracked it with two pianos, acoustic guitar, and drums for the basic track. And then we added two more pianos. Then I think there's six piano tracks, two clavinet tracks, two bass tracks, kettle drums, and then two sets of drums. We just kept playing through it with different setups and piling stuff on top of the original take. And then we went and all sang it in the bathroom. You know, I mean, if you listen to it, it's pretty loose. It's a pretty loose thing, you know, overall. I mean, we just thought it was fun. You know, it sounded fun. We were matching it up against Be My Baby, and every time we put Be My Baby on, we go, oh, well, we got like 75% of it right, maybe. You know, unfortunately, I can't sing like Ronnie Spector, you know.
Right.
That would have made it probably a lot better.
Yeah, well, you know, you say that about being loose. I think the whole record feels loose. I mean, the thing that I like about it so much is, aside from changing styles, it just has the kind of, we're going to go in and make, you know, the kind of record we want, and, you know, we're not going to worry about fashion or what's popular or anything like that. We'll just go in and record the kind of songs we want to record.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, God, it's just so much easier that way. It's not like it just shouldn't be so hard. I don't think it should be so. I mean, it's really easy to think, wow, this is a really important record for us, you know, career-wise, or, you know, all those things. And then just, I can't take that kind of pressure. I have a lot more fun just thinking looking at the reality of it. You know, we get to make a record. We might as well enjoy it while it's happening. And do things that we've never gotten to do before, or take advantage of the fact that we have some money to spend on the production of this. So let's go ahead and rent the goddamn Kungas if we want them, you know?
Yeah, but that will Was that always your attitude toward recording and the business?
No, in the past I've always felt like it's best to like just try and collect moments on tape, and it's kind of overwhelmed by the possibilities a studio presents to you. So I've always in the past have like definitely always felt like it should be loose and like a kind of a document of the time and place and the songs you have at the time. But in the past, the whole I think the methodology was more to just play it live to eliminate all those possibilities and hopefully get like a solid performance that doesn't need anything else. And very rarely would we do overdubs in the past, just because we wanted to keep it pure. And this time around, I was really bored with doing that. And I was like, well, I don't care how pretentious it is or how stupid any of this stuff is. It's pretentious to make a record. It's pretentious to be in a rock band. It might as well revel in it, you know?
Yeah, but did you think about trying to recreate it live? And can you recreate it live, or do you care to recreate it live?
No, I don't care to recreate it live. I mean, we play the songs live, and they hopefully come across, but they come across in a different way, you know. If we went to make the record tomorrow with the same songs, I'm sure that a lot of them would be completely different. I mean, we tracked different versions of a lot of those songs that had nothing in common with the versions that are on the record. Just like, I think the idea is to get to a point as a musician, not like really thinking about being a virtuoso or anything, but just where you're comfortable like knowing what the song is and then adapting to how everybody feels at the time and like what the environment's like, or adapting to like an audience is the same thing. Certain songs will have more of an edge than the record some nights. Some nights it might just be kind of lethargic because of fatigue, but hopefully always like just an honest representation of what you're doing and thinking about at the time, you know.
Yeah. Did you save the alternate takes for the future box set?
That's the next record, actually. Yeah. The box set.
Okay. That'd be great.
Yeah. A box set of all original material, though.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many comparisons made between this and other records, and the one that I haven't read that really jumps out to me, I think, is several of these songs remind me of Muswell Hillbillies by the Kinks. Is that a record you know?
I love that record.
Okay.
That's like one of my favorite records of all time.
Okay.
Not very many people know about that record, because when they think of the Kinks, they think, you know, like the early 60s, You Really Got Me and all that stuff. But that's like my favorite period of the Kinks, like Everybody's a Star, Muswell Hillbillies.
Lola versus the Power Man or whatever.
Right. Like that period when he was like kind of like getting into American styles, but at the same time writing these really paunchy lyrics about, you know, being a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. So
like I'm sorry, Sitting in My Hotel on you know that song? It's on Everybody's a Star.
I haven't heard it in a long time.
I haven't heard it in a while either, but I did the other day, and I realized that I probably ripped off the idea behind that song in like maybe 13 different instances on this record.
When you sing "It's the End of the Century," just that those words, and on "Was I in Your Dreams," you sound like Ray Davies too, I think, you know.
Well, that's like ultimate flattery to me. I think Ray Davies is a pretty underappreciated like songwriter, and the Kinks a pretty underappreciated band in the grand scheme of things, you know. I don't think they've ever really got their due, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Same as like Mott the Hoople too. There's a lot of English bands that since everybody seems to focus on Graham Parsons and Neil Young and all that stuff with us, I always find it really weird that it just makes me think that nobody has paid that much attention to the bands that really are probably more operative in describing Wilco, you know.
Yeah, I would not have picked Mott, but I mean the Kinks, I just think thought were pretty obvious. But then again, you know, I've said that to people, and they're like, I don't know that record. And you grew up in Belleville, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you know that record? Did it make a? I mean, it's weird. Things like that didn't seem to make a huge impact in the Midwest.
Well, I mean, it might not be like, you know, every kid in the, you know, I don't know. records aren't like they used to be. The seed with the CD thing, God, damn near the history of recorded music is available to anybody, anywhere. And it's just a matter of being interested in it. And I've been interested in it for a long time, since I had buying ridiculous amounts of music to try and find stuff that keeps me going, you know. And some point in time, I don't remember when, the Kinks thing happened for me, and I always feel like I should try and find everything that you can by something that really inspires you that way. And Mossville Hillbillies record really jumped out at me, you know.
Yeah. No, that's great, because I grew up in New York and I've lived in Indianapolis for 9 years, and when I talk about bands like the Kinks, I get a lot of blank stares from people, you know.
Yeah.
And living in Springfield, the same thing, you know. Just I people come over and see my records, and I'd have all this stuff that they'd never seen or heard of before, uh-huh. which is unusual. So.
Well, I mean, you can't find it all. That's the best thing.
Mm-hmm. Red-Eyed and Blue. That song reminds me of something, and it's just not coming to me. Is there a particular influence on there? I mean, especially early on in that song, the verses.
The chord progression initially kind of, it sounds like an Eddie Money song.
No, that's not it. I wasn't thinking of that.
No, not really. I mean, that was like one of the songs we were just playing, you know, just trying to like, we liked it really, was really sparse at the top like that, and it wasn't the kind of song we really felt like we could make it into a full band kind of thing, so just kind of created its own little universe. I don't know how, but wasn't really thinking of anything specific. On most of the stuff, really, it was more like later recognizing that sounds like this or that sounds like that. The only song that really set out to make it sound like something was the second version of Out of Sight or Out of Mind.
The two discs idea, I just think that was an absolutely brilliant idea, because I think I've read where you said, well, we could have cut one song off and fit this on one disc, but it's impossible to listen to 70 minutes in a row, isn't it?
It's not good for you, no.
Yeah.
Like, at some point during a 70-minute listen, you're going to start thinking about all the things that you got to be doing, you know? And that's what was great about records, you know, like, 15, 20 minutes on a side, and then you either listen to the other side or you get back to it in a couple days and you know where you left off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
With CDs, if you listen to the first half, you never really go to the middle of the CD and start listening to the second set, you know. It's like you get to make two sets out of it, and with doing two CDs, we kind of got to do that, because it's more tolerable to listen to 35 minutes and then 40 minutes at a sitting.
Yeah, how did that go over? Are the record company okay with that? And does it cost a lot more to do it that way?
Well, no, it doesn't cost that much more. CDs are really cheap to manufacture, but we did a couple. I mean, that was the only thing we really had to debate, was like how to make it cheap. And we like the cardboard packaging, surprisingly enough, was cheaper to do. And we took a royalty cut so we could make it cheaper.
Oh, well, that was nice of you.
Well, it's a percentage of nothing, so it's okay.
Oh, really? You're that you're expecting that to do that well?
Yeah.
A percentage of nothing. That's great. There's obviously a lot of talk and a lot of things have been written about this band and alternative country. And did you deliberately try to get away from that on this record?
I'd be lying to say that we didn't talk about it a little bit, but more than trying to get away from it, we never really saw ourselves as that. You know, we never really thought that was the goal or the idea behind the band, you know, was to be part of a country rock thing. You know, we felt like we just didn't want to be afraid of, I don't know how to put it. I mean, we just went into it saying, more than we really want to get away from this, we were just saying we really want to like not think about that and do things that we feel are honest to what we really like, you know.
Yeah, because I mean, alternative country sounds cool, but from what I can see, it's not like the hugest movement around. Plus, you know, you really don't sound very country or alternative, really.
I think it would have really killed us and killed, like, the whole idea for us. And maybe it would have been really easy for us in a way to go in and make a pretty straightforward record that just had, like, those kind of songs on it, like Forget the Flowers and, you know, whatever had a country element to it. I think we could have made a record, even off of just the stuff on the double record, we could have probably put something together that fit into whatever idea they're trying to proliferate as a, you know, being a movement, you know. But it wouldn't have been very satisfying for us.
Yeah, besides being part of a movement, I don't think that pays off very well. I mean, I know that's not what you're looking for, but it's like, you know, movements are nice, but they die out. And then you got to find your way back into the, you know, the kind of public consciousness again.
I've always just admired bands that were bands, you know, that,
right.
That yeah, I mean, if you know, on a totally different level than just making the record, Wilco is definitely trying to distance ourselves from the whole notion that we're poster child, you know, poster kids for some alternative country rock movement, you know.
Yeah.
Like, that's ridiculous. Who needs that?
Exactly. Two other things, if I can, I'll let you go. Do you have any relationship with your ex-bandmate in Sunvolt?
Mike? Sure. I talk to Mike occasionally.
No, that wasn't the person I met, but okay. but not the other one, huh?
I don't talk to Jay very often, no.
Oh, okay. And finally, for another story I've been doing, I'm asking everybody I interview, what's the strangest, funniest, oddest encounter that you've had with a fan?
Oh, there's been pretty many bizarre ones. Let me think. I don't know. Let's see. I've had a lot of weird ones that kind of relate to Uncle Tupelo since Wilco started, you know.
Okay.
I don't know how interesting that would be for your article.
No, I don't know. Go ahead, tell me one.
This woman come up to me after a show, and she had the Wilco CD, and she asked me to sign it, and I signed it, and she asked me if I could get everybody else to sign it, and everybody after a show is generally all over the place, you know, at the bar, or, you know, in the van or the bus, or you know, so I like. But, okay, and I went and tracked everybody down to sign this woman's CD. This isn't very exciting.
No, go ahead.
I had it all signed up, and I brought it back to her, and I handed it to her, and she goes, you know, I really liked Uncle Tupelo a lot better than Wilco. And I said, fuck you. Give me that back. I'm going to give you one that's not signed, you know. Like, what's the point? I really liked what you were wearing yesterday a whole lot more than whatever you're wearing today.
I really liked you before you opened your mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really liked you before you said something so stupid. That's just incredible. That is just incredible.
And then there was some other people, like fans came up after that, and I was like still flabbergasted, you know, so I told them the whole story. Mm-hmm. And one of them said, oh, you must get that a lot. I said, you know, you can all go to hell. Leave me alone.
Well, I'll tell you the exact opposite. I like Wilco a hell of a lot better than Uncle Tupelo.
Me too, man. I don't understand it. Just kidding. No, I'm like happy with Uncle Tupelo. I'm happy people remember it and all that stuff. But, you know, it's like, I always want to feel like your best stuff's ahead of you, or like, you know, it's just more in the moment than worrying about that. I had a similar experience in Oslo recently. We were playing, and people get totally out of their mind drunk when you play in Norway. There's this kind of sort of upwardly mobile looking middle-aged man, looked like he might have been a rock critic, I don't know, standing there, and we're playing, and he yelled for Sunken Treasure, you know, so we played it. And he yelled for The Lonely One. I was like, okay, so we played it. You know, we were doing a lot of songs. He yelled for Box Full of Letters, and we did a waltz version of it, which we've been doing a lot lately, you know, like a slowed down kind of country version of Box Full of Letters, just to keep ourselves interested, you know. Then we went off and came back on, and before I could get on the stage, he stopped me and wanted me to sign his CD. And I said, I'm going up to play right now. Can you wait until we're done? He's like, no, sign now. So I signed it, and he's like, no, to me, my name is, I don't know, what his name was. Like, huh, yeah. It's Sven or something. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. I just signed my name. That's as good as he can get right now. We're like, everybody else is on stage waiting for me. So we go up, and we start playing some more songs, and we're in the middle of a song, and he walks up to the front of the stage. It's just like a restaurant, really small, really low stage. He comes up, and he goes, play Box Full of Letters. And like, we played it for you, man. We played every one of your requests. And he was like, no, you did not play it. I want an electric box full of letters because my box is only half full of letters.
Oh, man.
You're the most demanding person I've ever encountered in my life. Like, most people would be thrilled to get like one song played that they yelled out
for. That's for sure. Yeah.
So then I sang Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow to him after I gave him a bunch of shit from the stage. I told the whole story right after that song on stage. I'm like, this guy here, stand up, show everybody who you are. You know him. I mean, I'm sure you've seen him. He's been requesting songs all night. We've been accommodating this man all evening. He's still not satisfied. So I sang Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow to him and sat on his lap.
Oh, man, good.
He was like, he wouldn't talk to me afterwards. I felt like that was the desired effect.
That's just great. Man, after all you did for that guy, that is funny. That's funny. Anyway, anything else? There was one other thing I forgot to ask you. Your fiddle player left, right? Do you have somebody else playing?
We don't have a fiddle player, but we have a guy who's traveling with us is playing pedal steel and some national and just some, you know, various string stuff to kind of create. Actually, the pedal steel helps a lot with the new material because it can kind of cover some of the organ parts and some of the more droney things that are happening on the record. And Jay switches off now between guitar and piano and organ, so we have those things live now too.
Okay, and the new guy's traveling with you. Who is he?
He's Bob, Bob Egan. He used to play in Freakwater.
Okay, all right. And anything else you want me to tell people that we haven't talked about?
We wear size 10 shoes almost across the board if they want to bring us some shoes.
Okay. Do people bring you shoes?
No.
Okay. All right.
But I like shoes a lot.
Okay. Well, any particular kind? Bruno Mali's? Those?
Yeah. Versace.
Yeah.
Slip-ons.
Mm-hmm.
You know. No, I'm just kidding. I actually do have a lot of shoes, but.
Okay.
No, I can't think of anything.
All right. That sounds great. Listen, I appreciate your time, and I'm looking forward to seeing you. See you next week.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tapes Archive podcast. Please remember you can always find more information about the show and the individual episodes at our website, thetapesarchive.com. Until next time, the vault is closed.